Well, I've pressed the big red button, so we can go ahead and start whenever you guys want. So let me go ahead and do the cheesy intro then. That's on me. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Vamp Podcast. I am your cherubic and lovable host, Mike Lafferty. And here with me tonight, I have regular co-host, Mr. Jason Tondreau, a.k.a. Dr. Comics. You can find his blog on Blogspot, where he will enlighten and drop wisdom on you when regular intervals. Mr. Jason, good to have you, sir.
Hi, it's great to be here. I can't claim to being cherubic, though. That's a great word.
It just came into my head, and I wanted to say it. I can't even tell you why.
Well done.
Yeah. And we have a gaming legend, and I use that word a lot because I'm friendly, like to compliment people, but in this case, it's not usually any kind of ironic humor. Steve Long is a gaming legend, and it's an honor to have him on the podcast. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Jason, good to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, hey, you know, before the podcast started, we were talking about the Champions Online video game, and my experience has been that when we say we want to continue a conversation in the podcast that we're having before the podcast, we need to have it right away or we forget completely. So,
fair enough.
Okay. Well, I think Jason was asking sort of what effect the MMO had on Hero with the game company. Was that right, Jason?
Well, I remember that because I'm a lifetime subscriber to Champions Online. And
sure, me too.
And the game I thought we were going to get is not the game that we got. Now, that doesn't mean it's not fun. I do enjoy the game. But what I always loved about Hero and about Champions, and I ran the hell out of Champions for over a decade. I mean, all through undergraduate my years, Champions was my game of choice. What I loved about Hero, and I think you, because this is back when you were still a player, too, even before you had started to write for the company, because I remember Dark Champions and all those books that when you first started to write for the company.
Sure, back in the early 90s.
Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking all the way back to the George McDonald days, you know, when what really I thought was great about Hero was how it played superheroes straight. You know, it played, those characters were very serious, and there was an effort by all the writers to create characters who were real human beings, you know, and they were identifiable, and even the villains had something that we could identify or sympathize with them, even if it was the absurd tragedy of their ridiculous origin. And I thought that, you know, your work with the company, both before you became an owner and then after you became an owner, and believe it or not, this is sort of leading up to our topic for the podcast later on, I always thought it made a great effort to do this, to maintain these characters as sort of real people, you know, three-dimensional characters, and that we could not only fight in an evening of grand battle, but who we could also have really interesting stories about. And this is what disappointed me about the online game was that it's very comic. It's very comedy. I mean that not in the sense of a comic book, because that can be funny or serious as the writers want, but it's very tongue-in-cheek and kind of camp in a lot of ways.
Sure, no, I see what you're saying.
And that's what disappointed me about the game. But as that was all happening, as that game was all being created, I remember that they basically bought Hero and then, like, sold you back the license. Is that right?
Well, not exactly, no. What they bought from us was the Champions IP. They bought, you know, the Champions universe and the characters associated with it, like, you know, Defender and Dr. Destroyer and Mechanon.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't buy the company, and they specifically didn't buy the Hero System rules, nor did they buy any of our other IPs. They didn't buy any of the fantasy settings I'd created, for example. So they bought those characters and then used them as is or redefined them as they saw fit.
Yeah.
And we've mirrored that in the books that we've published since then.
I
think to the extent that the game is, the MMO is campier than the tabletop game.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know for certain because I wasn't involved in designing the MMO, but my guess would be that that's simply the easiest way to present an MMO. The more depth you try to give to characters and character interaction in any type of computer game, the more difficult and expensive I think it becomes from talking to friends in that industry. And so it was probably just a choice of figuring out how they could best present the material they had, and that was how they felt they should go with it.
Well, who was their lead writer at first? I remember you talked to him a lot. I can't remember his name.
The guy that I mostly talked to was a fellow named John Lees, who's done a lot of writing for DC. He created the comic Chew, among others.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. He did a lot. He was not the only one, though. Diana Sherman and a bunch of other people, and I dealt with all of them on a pretty regular basis, and they would, you know, call me with questions or ask me, you know, hey, who do you have that does kind of like this, and would go here, and I would give them whatever information I had.
Yeah. Well, John Lee, is that the name of the guy that I'm thinking of?
Lees, L-E-E-S.
Lees.
I'm not sure if you pronounce it Lees or Lees. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah. Well, as I recall, most of his comics work has been kind of satirical and sort of poking fun at traditional superheroes. Is that a fair statement?
I've only read some of his work. I haven't read a lot of it. I mean, I know he has a real love of comics. He and I have talked about him at some length.
Oh, sure.
But I don't know, and he certainly was not the only one doing the writing on the game. You know, MMO is too big for any one person,
That's right.
Not sure how much one person's voice would come through.
Well, so did the MMO affect your company in terms of sales? I mean, was it a...
I think it did. I mean, it's very difficult to track these things, of course, particularly in the first year after the MMO was announced, we did see what I would call a statistically significant noticeable spike in sales of things we would consider, you know, beginner or introductory material, like core rule books, the champion genre book, things like that. And we did notice an uptick in sales, and, you know, we have no way of proving it, but our assumption is that comes from the MMO. You know, and similarly, ever since then, we've had, you know, there are always people, you know, in the MMO community who are interested in learning more about the lore and who might otherwise never have bought our book. So
they'll pick up the Millennium City source book, for example.
Exactly. Or you know, whatever we happen to be coming out with, the villains books or, the Book of the Empress, for example, or anything like that. It just depends on what interests them. I know there were several of the people who participate a lot on the message boards who were really interested in aliens and outer space stuff.
That's right.
And when we released Champions Beyond back in May or June, I know several of them bought that book because they specifically commented to me about it. And those are sales we otherwise, you know, probably never would have gotten. So, you know, I think the game, the MMO, has had a positive effect for us overall. You know, it's also given us access to art and to a lot of material we'd otherwise never have used. I mean, you know, one of the fascinating things about what Cryptic did with the MMO is they took things that we had only briefly mentioned or that we had tossed in a sort of throwaway bits of lore and developed them into entire zones and aspects of the game. You know,
that's right.
I would never have done a book on Monster Island if they hadn't developed it into a zone. That was a couple of throwaway paragraphs for fun because Darren and I like big giant monsters.
Yeah.
You know, the whole moon chapter in Champions Beyond derives entirely from things that they were doing or planning to do in the MMO. You know, and for that matter, so do the chapters on the Gadroon and the Kular, who were both alien races. I created I created one and Darren created the other as throwaways to, you know, as part of the standard comic book lesson of don't mess with Earth.
Yeah.
You know, and the funny thing about it is, and I'm constantly poking fun at some of the Cryptic guys about this, is for 8 years, I had sprinkled mentions through Champions supplements about a coming invasion of Earth by an alien race called the Hazeel. I'd been setting this whole thing up and eventually wanted to do a big source book about the Hazeel invasion of Earth.
Yeah.
And so what does Cryptic do? They totally ignore every mention of the Hazeel, pick two races that had been killed off already, turn them into spotlight races, and never put a single Hazeel in the MMO.
Right.
And it's made me laugh ever since, but that gave me two big chapters in Champions Beyond that I otherwise never would have had. That Kular and Gadroon stuff derives from Cryptic. So, I mean, they make real, you know, serious contributions to the setting, and I think it's great. I love the interaction I've had with them and the way we've sort of bounced ideas off one another or been able to, you know, derive useful working material from each other.
Now, the Book of the Empress, that's focusing on it. Tell me how to pronounce her name, because
her name is Dvatha Vahan.
Yeah, okay. I've been saying it right for years. Okay.
Yep, you have been saying it right for years. Yeah, she's one of our major, what we call, master villains.
Yeah.
And this book is similar. We've previously done the Book of the Destroyer, which was about Dr. Destroyer, and the Book of the Machine, which is about Mechanon.
Yeah.
So this is another book sort of in that series. taking a very detailed look at a single major villain and what he, or in this case she, can bring to your campaign.
Yeah, and I love books like this because they're like a campaign in one book, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and
maybe we should set up just a little bit for some of our listeners. Kind of the big reason behind having a conversation with Steve is to promote that Book of the Empress is on Kickstarter.com. If you go to Kickstarter.com, Google Book of the Empress, you'll come to Steve's Kickstarter page. Their goal is $10,000, and they've raised almost half of that in just 3 days.
Wow.
Yep, we're at 42% the last time I checked an hour or two ago.
Do you guys have like promotions for big donors and stuff?
We do. The promotion started, the lower level promotions are things like, you know, for $25 you get a PDF of the book and your name in the credits, and for $50 you get the book itself and a PDF. But I think the good ones are, you know, the highest level one is for $2,000. If you donate, pledge $2,000 to back the project, I'll come to your home and run a, you know, game for your group of gamers. You provide the gamers and the snacks, and I'll show up with a scenario based on the material in the book and bring you a bunch of signed copies of the book and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Now, for those of you that are listening, I have sat in at Steve's famous Gen Con sessions when he would run with all the old hero.
Oh, my Special Violence Task Force games, yes.
That's right, yeah, that's right. And they are a fantastic time. So you guys are... You have a treat ahead of you, whoever ends up making the big donation to make this book a real event.
Hey, Steve, if someone has you at their house, what kind of snacks are you more inclined towards?
Oh, you name it. You know, the usual, you know, Doritos et al. Are usually fine for me. But, you know, there aren't too many snack foods I haven't met that I don't like.
So how, for those of you that maybe are just don't know enough about the champion setting, I know a lot about Isfatha Mahan, but it's much more fun if you tell us about her.
Okay. Well, Isfatha Mahan is, or her subtitle, if you will, is Empress of a Billion Dimensions. She is a dimensional conquering supervillain. In the multiverse of the Champions universe, she rules an empire of about 100 million dimensions and is intent on adding Earth's dimension to her realm. She's tried several times, but the superheroes of Earth have always, you know, thwarted her and driven her off, and so, you know, the sort of the basic plot involved with her is her current plans to launch yet another invasion. The big question that has always arisen in the minds of Champions gamers is, you know, who like to look at these things and think about them in detail, is how do you rule an empire of 100 million dimensions, and if you're that powerful, why don't you just steamroll her over Earth?
Yeah.
And so part of the fun of writing the book is having to explain, how does her empire work? How does she launch an invasion? What are her plans for Earth? How do these things go off? And why is it that she doesn't just steamroll her over Earth?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
This is the sort of stuff that anybody writing a Kang the Conqueror storyline has to think about.
Yeah, very much so. You know, in that, like Kang, in addition to being able to travel dimensionally, she can travel through time. You know, so she can jump around to do all kinds of things, making her the ideal villain for many game masters because she can, you know, show up and do whatever you need her to do. But
yeah,
certainly if you wanted to compare her, give her an analog in the comics, she would be sort of our version of Kang the Conqueror.
But with the romantic subplot.
Yes, the fact that she's a woman means that in the typically male-oriented group, you can certainly get a romantic subplot going if you want to. I don't really touch on that much, but it's certainly there. I discuss her, you know, amongst other things, her sort of social circle and, you know, the string of lovers she keeps around and what happens when she gets tired of them. And,
well, come on,
you
know, drafting a handsome male superhero to become her consort in exchange for peace with Earth, that would be awesome.
That would be all kinds of fun, absolutely.
Hal Jordan is your man for that job.
You know, I think one of the fun part for me of Isfatha Mahan as a villainess is the idea of running an entire sort of sub-campaign or story arc where the characters don't just stop her from invading Earth, they strike into her territory, and you spend potentially months and months of game time of them traveling between dimensions, fomenting rebellions, and interacting with her on some level. Because the thing that makes her so fascinating is that as villains go, she's a really nice person. You know, she's not like Dr. Destroyer or Mechanon, who wants to wipe out all life on Earth, or Dr. Destroyer, who's a ruthless tyrant. She comes in and takes over dimensions and makes life better for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's her usual method of conquering troublesome planets, is to say, look, here's the deal. You know, you can submit to me right now and watch your standard of living go up, you know, 1,000%, and your level of technology triple, you know, or I can go to war with you and kill half your population.
Yeah.
Take your pick. And
yeah.
She genuinely cares about her subjects. It's
yeah.
just that she thinks she's the one who knows what's right for everybody.
Right, right.
Hey,
you know.
Steve, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Have you ever read Fables?
Oh, yeah, I love Fables. I have the full run of it up through, well, I guess I'm a couple graphic novels behind at this point. I sort of fell out of buying comics for a while.
Well,
but yeah, I love Fables. I think Fables is awesome.
Forgive me the question, but the way you're describing the address reminds me a lot of Geppetto.
You're right. I had never thought about that, but it does, you know, there are some valid parallels that you could draw there. Absolutely.
I think
you know, she can be utterly ruthless and cruel if she needs to be, because sometimes you have to be when you're ruling octillions of sentient beings.
I would probably run her with a sort of Queen Elizabeth vibe, mostly because of my background.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I've always liked about Isbatha, about her particular plot line, is that because she rules so many multiple dimensions, this has potential crossover for all the mystic and magical characters in
very much so
setting as well. So can you outline for us kind of like what we're looking at in the contents of this book?
Sure. I can go over it pretty much chapter by chapter for you.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be fun as well.
You know, the first chapter starts with the history of Isbatha the Hun. From the time as a young woman she discovers she has these powers up until more or less our present day. You know, we know from established champions' history that she's still ruling her empire 1,000 years from now in the year 3000, but I can't cover that much in a book and keep it at any reasonable size.
Yep.
But the fun part of it is, because she's a time traveler, that the dates go in chronological order. But I also say what age she is when she does these things. So it'll be like, you know, 1940, you know, age 23, she does this. 1950, age, you know, 380, she does this.
Yeah.
1960, age, you know, 13, she does this.
Yeah.
Because her perception of when, you know, her subjective perception of her age and when she's doing things differs from the objective time stream.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's cool.
You get a lot of jumping around, and there are a couple times where she fails to do something and then comes back 200 subjective years later when she has more resources at her command and finishes the job. So it's kind of fun writing the history of a time-traveling dimensional conqueror.
Yeah, yeah.
So I delve into that in Chapter 1. There's a certain emphasis, of course, on the last 20 or 30 years when she's been attacking Earth, for obvious reasons.
Uh-huh.
The second chapter looks at the Empress herself. It's a detailed look at her powers and how they work, her psychology and her motivations, you know, even such things as, you know, what is her daily routine like? How does she, you know, take in and, you know, deal with all the information she has to process on a daily basis? How does she, you know, socialize? All that kind of stuff. The third chapter is the one that I think will attract the initial attention from many GMs, because it covers her military in exhaustive detail. It starts with her Imperial Battalion of superhumans. She has, you know, thousands of them on her payroll, basically.
Yeah.
And it gives character sheets for six of them and brief one- or two-line descriptions of 200 or 300 more.
Okay.
Because I basically we have a series of books called Champions Villains that detail 300-some main villains in the Champions universe. And I take all those villains, and in one or two lines I change them. I say, you know, convert this villain this way, and this is an example of somebody who's working for her. That way you continue to use resources you have, and I don't have to publish 300 more character sheets.
This is like the Shi'ar Imperial Guard.
In a sense, yes. It's even larger, but that's a very good comparison.
But yeah, we take all these characters that everybody already knows, because, of course, the Shi'ar Imperial Guard are all based on the Justice League.
Yeah, on the Justice League, absolutely.
Not on the Justice League, on the Legion of Superheroes.
Well, yeah.
they're all based on Legion of Superheroes, and we'll take all of them and we'll just kind of reskin them. And so it's kind of like a nice little tribute. We'll just reskin all these other old Champions villains, and you can sort of have your own. That's awesome.
Exactly. But then it delves into her, you know, her, you know, low-level foot soldiers, through her chain of command, her military technology, her vehicles, you know, her espionage organization, her scout service, all the nuts and bolts, because, you know, that's the sort of thing that superheroes are going to be fighting sooner or later. Chapter 4 steps beyond her organization, if you will, to look at the multiverse of the Champions universe as a whole. Before I can discuss her empire and how she rules it, I have to explain what the overall multiverse is like. And this is material that actually it has been published to some extent before.
Yeah.
It's based on Dean Shamshak's work in a book we published called The Mystic World.
Yeah.
But I've had to take that and expand on it significantly, because in The Mystic World, Dean was looking at everything from a totally mystic perspective.
Yeah.
And here, like you say, you know, I not only have to look at the mystic angle of things, because the Empress is very aware of the mysticism in the multiverse, and it's, you know, sort of the mystic underpinnings that underlie it, but also from a scientific perspective. So this chapter includes all that information and a lot more. It's got like a dozen sample alternate Earths that your characters can visit, and another dozen sample dimensions, in addition to discussing the overall structure and how you travel from dimension to dimension. So even if you don't want to use the Empress, you could use the multiverse itself as a setting in your campaign, and its rules for how you travel here, how you travel there, and how the different dimensions interact.
Hey, Steve, could you, sorry to break in for just a second. Could you give us an example of just a couple of your multiverses, of your parallel Earths?
Sure. Some of the alternate Earths are historical variants. Like, for example, there's one called Walking World, where there are no fossil fuels or draft animals, so basically you can only travel distances that you can safely walk, which significantly inhibits any number of things in how civilization develops, obviously. You know, so you can't have any enormous empires. You have patchworks of tiny kingdoms. That's one. One that I'm sure the fans will enjoy, there's Foxbat World, where Foxbat is the greatest guy on Earth, and everybody loves him, and he's simultaneously the, you know, greatest villain and the greatest hero and the world's greatest rock star and a multi-Oscar-winning actor.
So he's just like Justin Bieber.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I've got...
I'm going to apologize for that joke right now. I feel bad for having made it. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yep. I've got a couple. I've got one called Malva World, where the Malvans, which are a powerful alien race in the Champions universe, but decadent and lazy in the quote, real Champions universe. In Malva World, they're not like that at all, and they basically rule several galaxies and are a potential major thorn in Iswathavahan's side. You know, the heroes could go and team up with the Malvans of Malva World to help fight her off, but then run the risk of attracting their attention and maybe getting conquered by them. So, you know, coming up with alternate Earth is kind of fun. I deliberately tried to avoid anything that was too simplistic, like, you know, this is the world where dinosaurs take the place of people, or this is the world where everything is run by Romans.
Yeah.
You know, those ideas are pretty easy. Anybody can come up with them. I was trying to do things that had a slightly different variation or a little bit more historical depth.
So there is no evil goatee universe.
There's no what?
No evil goatee parallel Earth.
Well, as a matter of fact, you can't get away without an evil goatee universe. So we have what's called Left-Handed Earth, which is something we've published or touched on briefly in Teen Champions, a book we published several years ago. And I fleshed that idea out a little bit. It was created by... Alan Thomas, who used to work for it.
Okay.
So you can't get away. I can't do a book like this and not have a evil twin universe. I can't do that. So
now, just real briefly, I have to put a plug in for Dean. Dean's wonderful book, The Mystic World, and all the stuff he did on the Champions Multiverse setting, because it's all...
Oh, yeah, it's phenomenal.
It's a wonderful adaptation of William Blake's cosmology. And
it is, yes.
Those lit geeks out there, I mean, I spent a whole seminar on Blake, and I published an article on Blake, it's just so rich and so evocative, and it gives you a wonderful excuse to go into the original poetry and read it, and Blake's such a fascinating character in his conception of the universe and kind of how it's allegoric representations, how forces in the universe become incarnated in beings and in places, is so ripe for gaming and for meeting those people and going to those places. It's like, you know, you can't make this stuff up. Somebody else has already done it for you. It doesn't get any better than that.
I'm a big fan of pretty much all of Dean Chomchak's work. I think he's a great writer, and I love his imagination. And I particularly liked his Champions Universe multiverse setting, which is why I couldn't resist sort of updating it and
You
know, expanding it a little bit so that I wasn't just referring to mystic things, but also scientific phenomena. You know, I'm a big fan of all of the stuff that he's done, not just for us, but for many other companies. He's an awesome RPG writer.
You brought up a question earlier that is a good one, and I thought maybe I would ask you and see if you could answer it for us, if you're not spoiling anything, and that is, okay, so yes, if Alpha does have this enormous empire of 100 million dimensions, why doesn't she just steamroll over Earth?
Well, now you're getting into Chapter 5. You're giving me the perfect lead-in here. So Chapter 4 is the multiverse. Chapter 5 then looks at the specific part of the multiverse that she rules. And what it basically boils down to is this. Ruling 100 million dimensions doesn't mean that you can effortlessly do anything you want. She's got to deal with internal politics, and specifically she has to deal with the fact that she has at least two other major enemies, Tyranon the Conqueror and Scarn the Shaper, who are dimensional conquerors much like herself.
Yep.
And they're in constant rivalry and competition. You can think of it almost with a World War I analogy, where they've sort of established multi-dimensional trench warfare and are holding one another off.
Eurasia will always be at war with East Asia.
Exactly. So it takes her an enormous amount of administrative effort to move billions and trillions of soldiers around, and if she moves too many of them into any one dimension at any one time, she runs the risk not only of leaving herself vulnerable to Tyranon and Scarn, but to having revolutions pop up in dimensions that aren't fully pacified yet, because some of her dimensions, you know, everybody loves and adores her because it's the only thing they've known for hundreds or thousands of years, but others are not, you know, fully under her thumb yet, and revolution can break out any minute.
Sure.
So as boring as it sounds, it boils down to logistical, administrative, and strategic decisions.
Yeah.
If she really wanted to do it, she could steamroll Earth. There's no question. But if she does it, she leaves herself so vulnerable that she's likely to find herself out of a job pretty quickly.
That's cool.
And she's not that stupid. You know, she has an ego, no question about it. You kind of have to have one if you're going to rule a 100 million dimensions. But, you know, the plain fact of the matter is that she's not going to sacrifice, you know, everything that she's gained over centuries just to take over one annoying dimension. She knows she'll get us sooner or later.
Yeah.
She just has to be patient. So she's gearing up for another try in, I think it's technically planned for 2017. But you know, cause it takes years and years to line everything up and get everything ready.
That's right.
Just like, you know, when we decided we had to invade Europe in World War II, you know, D-Day wasn't just thrown together in 2 weeks. That kind of thing. So Chapter 5 looks at that. It looks at how she plans and executes an invasion and what happens after she invades and conquers a dimension. But it also looks at things like, you know, how's her bureaucracy set up? You know, what does the Ministry of Technology and Science do?
Yeah.
You know, what's life like in the Imperial Palace back in her home dimension?
Looks like Chapter 6 is going to be suggestions on using the Empress in your campaign and plot these whatnot.
That is pretty much it. Chapter 6 covers dimensional campaigning in general. The first part of it discusses how to use the Empress, and it has plot seeds and little bits and pieces like that that specifically relate to her. The second part of the chapter, though, is generic. And again, a lot of this derives from some of the work that Dean Chomchak did in another book of ours, The Ultimate Mystic. It discusses how you create your own dimensions, how you establish a multiversal structure, how you deal with travel between dimensions, and how you can plan an entire campaign based around dimensional or planar travel, whether it's in a superhero setting or something like Amber, where people are jumping around between dimensions. And I think the funnest part of that is I did a whole section of random dimension generator tables, so that if you don't want to bother to come up with the basics of your dimension, you can roll on a few tables and it'll tell you, you know, this dimension is more magical than scientific. This dimension is roughly equivalent to this time period on Earth. This dimension is, people are like this,
et cetera.
And so it gives you the basics of your dimension and allows you to, you know, then proceed from there with adding on whatever details you think are necessary.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
You know, a lot of characters have done this in comics. They'll go off on a dimension-hopping quest that'll last for a year or so, and they almost always arouse the ire of the fans, who are like, well, you just put my characters back in New York City where they belong. But at the same time, you can tell that the writers are having enormous fun with it.
Absolutely. And I think in a gaming campaign, you get around a lot of that. You don't have to worry about what the fans are disliking because you've got the players right there contributing to things. And if they get really sick and tired of it, they'll let you know, and the GM can cut everything short. He doesn't have to deal with four-month lead times for writing scripts.
Yeah. And plus, you know, you could run a four episode, you know, sort of mini galactic tour, and it only takes a month of real lifetime, whereas that same thing would be, you know, a summer crossover event at Marvel.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the benefits that gaming offers that, you know, regular literature and movies don't.
Yeah. Do you remember an old Champions book? I think it was while you were writing, but it was before you had come in and bought the company. I think it was called Invasion Earth.
Yeah, Invasion's Target Earth. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, that book was so useful to me. Not so much because it was also an alien invasion source book, but of course it was much smaller. It was a thin book. It was maybe 64.
It was like a 32 or 64 page book. Yeah.
I didn't use any of the aliens in it, but it had this priceless 12-step breakdown for any alien invasion campaign. And I must have
remember that
by the numbers in at least three different campaigns, always to excellent success.
Yeah, no, that was I remember that supplement fondly. I don't recall who wrote it offhand, but yeah, I've got a copy of it downstairs.
Yeah. But so if someone wanted to take this Vatha Vihan invasion, which you have scheduled for 5 years from now,
yeah,
and they wanted to do it next week,
they absolutely could.
We have everything we need to do that?
Yeah, it's all there, everything you need. I mean, I have a specific, as opposed to the sort of generic 12 steps that you're discussing from Invasion's Target Earth, I have a very specific sort of seven-step procedure how she plans and executes an invasion.
Yeah.
And that's all discussed in Chapter 5. And then there's a specific section after that saying, here's how she's applying those steps to Earth.
Yeah.
She's currently in stage beta, and here's what she's doing in stage beta. Additionally, she's already doing the following planning for stage gamma.
Right.
So, yeah, the part of the whole reason for the book's existence is it's got everything you need to run an Istvatha Vihan invasion scenario from soup to nuts.
That's great.
Hey, Steve, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm going to have the NPCs do voices when I'm role-playing NPCs. Would the Empress be more of a Catherine Janeway or more of a Sarah Palin or maybe a Margaret Thatcher?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I'm telling you, it's Queen Elizabeth. Runner like Queen Elizabeth.
I would say it would probably be more of a Margaret Thatcher attitude but a Sarah Palin voice.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For the simple reason that as big a fan as I might be of Margaret Thatcher, I would never consider her voice sexy or alluring, and a supervillainess in a comic book needs to be alluring at some level. You know, I think you need a bit more of that sex appeal so that you can have the potential romantic interest subplot or the, you know, for love of you, I will give up this invasion kind of thing going on.
Yep.
Once again, I think Hal Jordan's your man for that. You want me to sex up an alien conqueror and save the Earth? I got you, boys. I will.
Yeah, either that or, you know, it's a Captain Kirk thing.
Yeah, that's right.
It's that Brannigan.
Zap Brannigan.
I kind of want to see that. I kind of want to play Zap Brannigan in an RPG now that I think about it. That would be awesome.
So. That would be kind of fun, actually.
Well, hey, can I ask you some business questions, Steve?
Sure.
All right, Hero Games is one of the few companies left, or it was one of the few companies left that had a full-time staff. The list is winnowing fast, and you guys, you know, you recently reduced down, you don't have any full-time staff anymore, and you're doing your books via Kickstarter, which is kind of a hot, you know, the new hotness in the RPG world. Do you see this as kind of a temporary stage, you know, kind of a lull because we're in this ongoing recession, or do you think this is the way forward for tabletop RPGs?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, historically, if you look at sales of RPGs, by and large, they have always declined slowly but surely. You know, historically, there are only two RPGs that have ever brought statistically significant numbers of new people into the RPG hobby. One of them is D&D, which started the hobby in the first place, and the other is Vampire the Masquerade, which, unlike D&D, did not bring in people who tended to then buy other RPGs. So, as the hobby has gone on, it tends to lose people to the demands of adulthood, you know, or other hobbies like playing MMOs,
yeah,
and hasn't, unfortunately, been able to replace them because there are just other distractions in life, and RPGs are a pretty high-intensity pastime. So this makes it difficult for companies that don't have a really significant sales volume, like Paizo, for instance, or Wizards of the Coast, to maintain themselves as a business with a full-time staff and, you know, all the other accoutrements that go with it. You know, we tried long and hard and made a go of it for 10 years, but eventually, between the nature of the RPG market and the nature of the economy currently, it just reached the point where we simply didn't have enough income to justify having, you know, so many people on staff. And specifically when we decided to scale back production, well, I, as the guy who was responsible for most of the production, am no longer as necessary. But Kickstarter provides a real opportunity to continue to produce things, and more importantly, to let the fans sort of vote and tell you in advance what it is that they want. You know, right now we're doing one that happens to have mostly been completed because it was a book I had been working on before we, you know, downscaled. But going forward, if the Book of the Empress Kickstarter succeeds, you know, I'm sure Hero will want to do more. And in that case, it'll be more an issue of saying, okay, let's figure out what the fans want based on polling them and discussing things with them, because we're always very open with our fans.
Yes.
And then we can put up, based on that information, we can say, okay, this seems like the Kickstarter project is most likely to succeed, and then they can hire me or hire someone to write that book on a sort of freelance basis, you know, if the Kickstarter for that project succeeds. So, you know, I think that Kickstarter, because of its way of letting you interact directly with the customers and letting the customers express their preferences sort of in advance, you know, voting with their dollars, you know, I think it offers a real opportunity for game companies, you know, to continue to produce material that people want without having to incur the overhead of maintaining a whole business.
Now, Steve, let me ask you a question, and I'm sure you get this a lot, so you'll forgive me if I haven't heard your usual answer. So forgive me on this, but I'm curious.
No, shoot.
So we acknowledge that it's hard to get new people into the hobby. So most of our customers in the role-playing market are people who are already playing other games. And if we're going to lure them, we're going to lure them from whatever game they're playing to try out Hero System as something new.
Yeah.
To pick up the rule book and check it out. Do you think that Hero's complexity and its fine-grained nature as a system, which is somewhat legendary in role-playing games in the industry, is one of the most detail-oriented systems out there? Do you think that that is a barrier to getting those players who are already playing something else to come try out Hero?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously it's a barrier for some people.
Yeah.
But the fact is that Hero is designed to appeal to people who want that level of detail,
yeah,
and there are gamers out there who want it.
Sure.
You know, not all gamers want it, just like not all gamers want low levels of detail.
Yeah.
You know, I think that if we were to try to change the Hero system to be less detailed and attract, you know, more,
yeah,
people, in theory, that,
yeah,
it would just do nothing more than alienate the existing,
yeah,
fan base that wants,
yeah,
a detailed game. Because,
yeah,
in today's market, there aren't many companies catering to that need, and,
yeah,
yet there are still people out there who want it. So, you know, I think that,
yeah,
you know, the best way for Hero to continue to, you know, to try to attract new people is to try to, you know, stay the course and do what it does best,
yeah,
and attract the people who want that. It's never going to be as big as D&D, as much as I hate that, because,
yeah,
that's just the nature of the beast. it's, you know, it's the sort of the top of the line thing. Just like, you know, you're not going to get as many people buying, you know, expensive bottles of Dom Perignon as you are buying, you know, cheap grocery store champagne.
You kind of have to dance with the girl that brung you.
In a sense, yeah.
You've got Hero System is, by its nature, a complicated, detail-oriented game system. And despite occasional experiments at creating a simpler version of it, and I'm remembering, geez, what was that called in the late 90s?
You're thinking of Fusion.
I am, yeah.
Yeah, which we don't even actually own the rights to and wouldn't have wanted them even if we could have gotten them.
And despite occasional experiments at creating a kind of introductory version of Hero, that this is what it is, and this is your corner of the market space.
Yeah.
And so better to develop that corner than try to alter your product.
Exactly, but
yeah.
We do actually have a nice introductory product. It used to be called Sidekick. We now call it just the Hero System Basic Rulebook, where I take the big core rulebook and boil it down to about 140 pages of the essentials. And we sell a lot of those. People like to keep it around as it's a good reference at the gaming table, and it's a good way to introduce people who are new, you know, to the game.
So we
have done our best to make the game, you know, approachable and appealable without, you know, sacrificing the bird in the hand, so to speak.
Yeah.
But there's just only so much that can be done.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally understand.
Hey, Steve, along those lines, can I ask you a follow-up question?
Sure.
I was thinking about this earlier today. You might have been following, there's a series of columns on The Escapist about the past, present, and future of D&D. And
I read one or two of those columns, I think, yeah.
And there's a funny quote from Mike Merles, I think, is the current developer of D&D. He referred to his customer base as persnickety, which kind of made me laugh. But where I'm heading with this is Ryan Dancy had a follow-up column he did for Ian World. And, you know, Ryan Dancy is a guy prone to speculation, and one of the things he brings up is he thinks that, you know, the way forward for RPGs, or maybe, you know, where successful RPG companies are in the future, is distilling the essence of the RPG experience into a family game or a party game. Something you can, you know, bring out, you know, learn 15 minutes from a pamphlet and play, you know, kind of like, you know.
Well,
Jason, go ahead.
A friend of mine works for AEG, and they've got probably half a dozen of these games.
I mean, Steve Jackson Games they still publish GURPS, but GURPS is pretty much PDF only now, and the big money maker is Munchkin.
Yeah.
Which incorporates or parodies, depending on your point of view, you know, RPG elements in a card game. I was wondering if you guys at Hero had ever thought about making that jump, and, you know, obviously, you know, Hero, you know, Champions are going to call it, always going to be kind of, you know, the first love, you know, maybe, you know, making the transition and doing, you know, a Munchkins-like product or something, you know, some other card game or table game that kind of, you know, bridges the gap that's, you know, crossover into mainstream.
Well, certainly at various points in time in the past 10 years, we, you know, hey, wouldn't it be interesting if we did this, you know, kicking around ideas, but we've never put any serious work into doing any of them. You know, our feeling has always been that, you know, the thing we love best and sort of our core competency is producing role-playing games and role-playing game supplements, and that's what we want to do.
The reason I bring it up is it doesn't really exist what I would call a pickup, you know, role-playing game for superheroes. I mean, ICOM kind of comes close, and I love it, I'm a big fan, but maybe there's a space that can be occupied there, so I just want to throw it out. And, you know, just because I'm opinionated and have a big mouth, I would suggest that your IP is really popular, people love it. I think if you were to do a Kickstarter for, say, you know, a book with a series of short stories, you know, set in the Champions universe, I think there would be a ton of people who would line up.
We talked briefly with, I think at some point, with Cryptic and some other people about that, and it's something we haven't pursued yet. The one fiction venture we did do years ago was a collection of pulp stories called Astounding Hero Tales. And it did okay, but not well enough for us to really seriously consider doing a lot more fiction. You know, personally, I've always been a little leery of superhero fiction because, to me, superheroes are a very visual medium. You know, I mean, obviously, I want my comics to be well written, but I want the writing and the art to go together. And just written fiction stories about superheroes always fall a little flat for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not saying there are not great superhero stories out there. There certainly are. I've read quite a few. It's just, you know, ultimately, somehow I don't feel they really get superheroes across in the best way.
I think.
But ultimately, too, you know, what has to be considered is that, you know, as the owners of the IP, Cryptic is the one who would have to make decisions about something like that. We could bring the idea to them if we wanted to do it, and they could approve it. But really, the IP is theirs to make the most use out of.
I see. I think the best superhero novel I have read is Soon I Will Be Invincible, which I used in my class.
Yeah, I've read that.
Yeah, and the students really enjoyed it. Well, you know, like any class, 9 out of 10 people love it, and 1 out of 10 people hate it. But and we also read Cavalier and Clay, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is not, strictly speaking, a superhero novel, but certainly is a novel about comics. But I can see what you're saying about the IP, and your natural decision is to kind of do products that you don't need anybody's approval to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that Cryptic is hard to work with. Cryptic has actually been phenomenally easy to work with.
I think
if we went to them and said, we'd like to do a collection of Champions Universe stories, they'd say, great, you know, it'd just be like any other thing we do, it would be subject to their approval.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't do a story where, you know, a major character got killed or some horribly graphic thing was done.
It
isn't something that we have wanted to pursue because we just feel we would be, you know, our time would be better spent focusing on, you know, our core game line and what our customers mainly seem to want, which is game books.
Do we have anything else coming out other than the Book of the Empress?
Right now, the Book of the Empress is the only thing because it's sort of a test bed.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, if the Kickstarter for Book of the Empress goes really well, then that leads us to, you know, want to do more Kickstarters because we've got a whole bunch of books we'd like to do. It's just a question of, you know, figuring out if it's economically feasible to do them.
Yes.
If the Kickstarter for Book of the Empress does not succeed, then we have to step back and ask ourselves, you know, can we try this with another book, you know, and see if that succeeds, or do we just take it as a sign that we shouldn't even bother trying?
But beyond that,
there's the question of licensing, you know, doing licensed products, where one of the things that the company is doing is sort of opening up its licensing terms to allow, make it easier for licensees, both existing and potential, to do, you know, other Hero System books that we wouldn't necessarily do. And, you know, so for example, even though I'm not employed by the company directly anymore, I'll probably try to Kickstarter a book or two as a licensee. I've got a couple that I talk about on my website that I'm interested in doing, and I've talked about on the Hero website.
Hey, Steve, what's your URL for your website?
As a matter of fact, I literally just launched it today. It's stevenslong.com.
Oh, cool.
StevenSlong.com. Short and simple. And it's fairly bare bones right now. I've got a couple articles up about fantasy because it's partly about my game writing and partly about my, you know, potentially foolish efforts to break into writing fiction.
Yeah.
So I've got some discussion up there about fantasy fiction, and I just posted a blog post today about one of these books I'm thinking of Kickstartering called Mythic Hero. You know, and just all the other usual sort of self-promotional, you know, things that you have to do in this day and age if you want to succeed as a creative.
Yeah. And I was reading a column that Eric Skarka wrote, God bless him, and after he had a wildly phenomenal success with his Far West.
It was Far West, yeah. No, he did amazingly well. I mean, we were all, you know, thrilled for him. I'm looking forward to seeing how that project turns out in the end.
And he mentioned he was thinking of doing Kickstarter for any kind of creative impulse in the future. And as a guy who occasionally publishes game supplements, I'm kind of thinking of doing the same. You know, I'm thinking of doing a line of game supplements for a system, do a Kickstarter for it to see if the fans are interested. Because the market being what it is, just kind of think like maybe it's a smart way to proceed.
So are you saying, Steve, that it's easier for other companies, like if a freelancer just wanted to write an adventure for Champions these days, can they do that?
Yeah, it's just a question of, you know, signing up as a licensee. The terms are incredibly reasonable. Writing for Champions specifically has the additional layer of needing to get approval from Cryptic.
Yep.
Just writing other stuff for Hero, like a science fiction setting or a fantasy setting, is very easy. It's just, you know, like I say, that the license terms are, I mean, they don't even involve paying any money. They just involve working with us to sell through our online store and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was one of the things, you know, if we're not going to be producing as much ourselves, we want to make it easier for other people to keep our customers happy with books.
Totally.
It works out great. It's sort of a win for us and a win for the customers and a win for the licensee.
Are there I'm sorry, Jason. Go ahead.
Are you still an owner, Steve?
Yeah, no, I'm still an owner of the company. I'm just not directly employed by it.
I see. Okay, I gotcha.
So today, if third-party publishers listening, this might be a golden opportunity to jump in on before lots of people rush there.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, if anybody out there is looking for a way to break into the business, Hero has one of the most wonderfully developed settings ever out there. And the rule system has been through so many iterations. You've got a whole huge base of loyal fans who are eager for new material. You know, if someone is looking to break into the gaming business and maybe write a freelance book, I mean, I can't imagine a better you'd be like a pig in a wallow. I mean, you know, you'd have every tool you could possibly want and a guaranteed audience, and all you have to do is about producing a high-quality book.
Yeah, and, you know, our fans are certainly not shy about telling you what they want and what they like.
Right.
Indeed. So, Steve, you go to a lot of gaming conventions, right?
I love gaming conventions. I don't know if I'll be doing as many this year as I have done in the past, but yeah, I do a few. I'm currently slated to be a guest at one up in Buffalo, New York in early April called UBCon, if I recall. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that name correctly.
Okay. Do you run games or do panels, or what do you enjoy most about this?
Well, I'll do a little bit of everything. My favorite thing to do at conventions is to do panels. I think that's the best way to sort of get the best use out of me, expose me to the most convention goers, as opposed to running a game where I'm locked together with the same five or six people for hours at a time. Yeah. But of course, people want me to run games, and I'm happy to run them. But panels are they're more fun. I get to be a talking head and, you know, have interesting interactions with fans about things I love discussing, you know, whether it's fantasy, my favorite fantasy fiction, or Ken Height and I do a great panel called Gaming Supplements Every Gamer Should Own. We've done that at a bunch of shows. I do a world design panel where we take 2 hours and we sort of design a world from the ground up. All kinds of things. I love doing seminars. My biggest complaint is at particularly smaller game conventions is they always are afraid to put me on. They think, oh, just a couple panels. But I'm like, no, I'll do all the panels you want. But not every convention is big enough to support a panel track. You know, you have to reach a certain sort of critical mass.
Yep.
You know, before panels become feasible. I think I'll be doing a couple. I'm also a guest at the local convention, StellarCon, which is coming up in early March, where I think their main literary guest is Pat Rothfuss, who is the author of the Kingkiller Chronicles, and a big Hero fan, and we're going to do a charity event where he's going to run a game set in his world, and I'm going to be one of the players, and we'll auction off the seats for charity.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
So what's Ken Hyatt like in person? Is this full on Rain Man, or is he more of a person you can talk to?
Oh, no, Ken is nothing like Rain Man. Ken is a great guy. He's immensely knowledgeable about all kinds of subjects and is, you know, witty and talkative, and I could go on for another hour saying good things about how cool Ken is. Ken is a great guy.
Yeah, I used to love his column on Pyramid, but I noticed that there's so many of them kind of evolved in this sort of orgasm of conspiracy theories and numerology. I kind of got to wondering. But, amazing writing. I really love his stuff. But,
Ken's suppressed transmission books are probably the most sound game resource I have on my shelf.
Oh, that's the column I was talking about. Yeah, I have gone.
Yeah, no, they're all kinds of fun.
Yes, so many campaigns that I have run have come out of those books.
Yes. Steve, if you and Steve Kenton are in the same room at a convention, is it kind of like the scene from Highlander? We guys kind of facing each other down, and there's, like, you know, some tension in the air. Is it more like Old West gunfighters, or what's that feel like?
If I were facing down who?
Steve Kenton.
Oh, no, God. Steve and I are friends. We get along really well. We, you know, chit-chat all the time. If we got together, it wouldn't be a sort of Highlander question. It would be more a, you know, hey, what's going on with this comic book or that comic book, or, you know, what the hell is, you know, Hal Mangold or one of our other friends up to? No, Steve and I get along. He's a great guy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just trying to be funny. But, all right, cool. Yeah, Steve is a great guy.
Well, what somebody should do, and I've often said this, and for all I know, Steve, maybe somebody already has, and I just haven't read it yet, is a Crisis on Two Earths, or a Crisis on Infinite Earths product, in which the characters of the Champions universe and the characters of another rival superhero game universe.
Oh, we already did that.
You did that.
We did that 5 or 6 years ago when Guardians of Order was doing Silver Age Sentinels.
Oh, yes.
We did a product called Reality Storm where we mushed the two together. And the whole product was an idea we came up with sort of drunkenly one night at a bar at Origins. After the Origins Awards, and when we sobered up the next morning, we realized, wait a minute, this is a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
And it snowballed from there.
But nobody plays Silver Age Sentinels anymore.
Yeah, sadly, true.
Yeah.
It's a shame when gaming products kind of fades out like that, because there have been some great ones over the years.
Yeah, no, you know, superhero games are, you know, they go through boom and bust cycles to a certain extent. There are periods where a lot of them are coming out and periods where there are just only a few, but it's, you know, a genre of gaming that has never entirely gone away.
This is true, this is true. Well, hey, Steve, I think we're kind of getting close to the one-hour mark, and I don't like to go on, I like to keep the podcast a reasonable length.
Okay.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Jason, appreciate your time as well.
Oh, no, it was a great opportunity to reconnect with Steve, and I really want to encourage everybody out there to jump in and look at that Kickstart project, because, you know, it's all kind of up to the fans. You know, is this game going to continue forward, and this setting going to continue forward, or is it not? And this is where we kind of stand up for the things that we love doing. You know, we have to chip in $5 or something and just tell these guys that you want to see this book go forward.
The great thing about Kickstarter, whether it's for the Book of the Empress or any other one, is you can pledge any amount of money you want. You know, we've got specific reward levels that say at this level you get this, you know, perk.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, if you want to pledge $1 or $62.50 or whatever, you know, you're more than welcome to do that. And I think it's a great way to, you know, show up and, like you say, you know, express your support for a great setting that, you know, deserves to be carried forward. That's sort of, you know, the thing that I like most about Kickstarter is that it sort of, in a sense, creates a partnership between us and the fans.
That's right.
To keep this really rich, extremely well-developed superhero setting not only alive, but expanding.
Yeah, that's right.
So for Champions fans or anyone out there who's a fan of superhero RPGs in general, this is kind of your save Ferris Bueller moment.
It is.
Go to Kickstarter.com, search the Book of the Empress, and, you know, if you're a cheap ass, just give them $1. That's all you can afford. But, you know, dig deep, because this is an interesting project. And, Steve, I know you've got some top-notch talent on this. I know for a fact that Fred Hicks is your layout guy.
Yes, Fred Hicks did the layout on this book, and the interior art is mostly by the Frame brothers, Brian and Brendan Frame. Because we have a long lead time for it, we were able to basically say, hey, you guys want to do all the art in this book? And there are a few other pieces by Storm Cook and some other artists, but, you know, 90-plus percent of it is by the Frame brothers, so it has this wonderfully unified feel to it.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, Fred has done the layout on most of our recent Hero System books, and he's a great guy to work with and an incredibly talented, you know, graphic director. So you're going to, you know, if you, you know, like the look of the Hero books you've seen recently, this will be right up that alley.
Yep, Fred does incredible layout work. Just look at the Dresden Files RPG and ain't mad about that. If his wall doesn't say bad mofo on it, it really should. So,
yep.
To sum up, folks, go to Kickstarter.com right now if you're a decent human being. So look for Book of the Empress and do the right thing. All the cool kids are doing it. You are cool, aren't you? All right, there we go. Steve and Jason, thanks for your time. Really appreciate you guys. Anything else you want to cover before we call it a podcast?
No, not at all.
Sweet. Okay. Well, in that case, hey, folks, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on the Bad Podcast. And we're signing off. So... Okay, we're no longer recording.